couple of friends at the back will tell me if you let me down.
Yeah, okay, please. So Steve, oh yeah, actually Steve 是 MIT 的教授，是 W3C 的这个 CEO。 那么这个 Tim Berners-Lee 呢是万维网 HTML 的发明人，也是我们在社会经常称之为万维网之父 Father of WWW。 所以这个 Tim 呢，由于他的杰出的贡献，获得英国女王在2004年授予的爵士勋章，因为英国女皇的爵士勋章在传统是贵族更多一些，对吧？世袭的，但是作为在不同的领域当中做出突出贡献的杰出的科学家呢，是可以被授予爵士称号的。因此，从他的这个工作，我们可以这样来体会：因为有了 HTML， 因为有了万维网。我们今天的互联网才变得真正的走线平民，真正的丰富多彩。也正是因为万维网，才使得我们现在的电子商务、电子政务和信息系统的建设得以在全球范围内广泛的来进行和推广。那么非常荣幸，3年前我们经过竞选获得了万维网大会的主办权。在去年The breakfast speech from John Tim's team. So Robin and I invited him to be to give us a keynote speech. 就是在去年的半夫的会的早餐会上，我们抓住时机来请他来做。尤其是我们这个 communication 的 head Harper's, and also specially from Steve's hand. So team agreed to come to Beijing to have a keynote speech. 所以这一点呢确实不容易，他是因为他的事务很忙，他也有很多经纪人，他的日程行程的安排都是他的经纪人安排的。那么他现在一直还在万维网技术在做这个研究和推动工作，尤其是在 Semantic Web, Social Network 以及关于 Web 的这个应用方面发挥着非常非常重要的作用。所以我觉得各位媒体的朋友，我是非常兴奋愿意跟媒体在一起接触，最重要的原因，透过我们的媒体使大众更多的了解万维网技术，使更多的人参与到万维网技术来推进它的发展。非常值得骄傲的说呢，中国在万维网技术自从2年前加入的万维网分部，我们现在已经有了这个9个会员，并且速度发展和应用呢非常快，而且这几年我们在推动这个the national standard based on WWW has got achievements. We have at least 6 the national standard, such as e-government, e-commerce has been set up in the whole country. And up to you know, many universities, almost university and enterprise.Pay much attention to this area, and from this conference, we also found many enterprises of the China engaged their efforts in this area, especially for software industry and computer industry and IT industry. They say all of our system are based on web service XML, based on WWW.所以我觉得在未来的发展当中，中国在互联网的技术有相当多的机会。尤其我特别跟记者朋友说的这句话，就是上午也说过，6年前杨致远发表的一篇论文大家广泛引用之后，我们就诞生了 Yahoo。 那么的的确确万维网技术创造了相当多的百万富翁和千万富翁， I mean WWWcreated million rich man, right? So rich person, Mr. Dr. Yang from Yahoo, Baidu and other enterprise. 所以万维网技术是一个非常令人吸引人，又是能够创造发挥创造性和产业发展的空间。所以我就不多讲了，我把我们大家向这个 team 啊，他难得来一次，你们多问问他的一些问题。Okay, that's all.
Thank you for the introduction. Wow.
All right. Okay, well, it's great to be here. This, so this is the World Wide Web Conference. We've had World Wide Web Conferences since, 1994. They've always been exciting because the web is a place of growth and change, and it's continually growing, it's continually changing. Now it's wonderful to be in China. China is clearly a base of growth and change. So, and in fact, if you look at the web in China, it's growing, and if you look at China on the web, it's growing. So what a lot of people felt when it started was a medium dominated by the English language. Now it's very international, and the amount of Chinese people expect to overtake the amount of English quite soon. So this is it's great to be here. As the web, in fact, is growing so much that it becomes really complicated science to understand how it behaves as a big complex thing. To try to show how big it is, there you can consider that there are a number of web pages out there, which is about 10 to the 11, 10 with 11 zeros after it. That is more than there are brain cells in your brain. And so the human brain is a very complex thing, and we have a special science to study it, and we don't really understand how it works. Even though people understand how one of the brain cells works, the way the brain works is still a mystery. Turns out there's a lot of mystery in how the web works. When somebody starts a new website, maybe it'll take off, maybe it won't. Some social networking sites become very, very popular overnight. Some social networking systems, they look very exciting. They just don't seem to work. They don't spread. What spreads? What doesn't? What systems out there on the web are going to be stable? Those questions become so frequent and so important because we depend on the web that we've started talking about a new field called web science. So web science is the science of the web. It's the science of the web. It's not just computer science, although there are a lot of computer scientists here in the building now. You can poke your noses into the rooms and see them arguing about the complexities of how computers work, but in fact, what they're interested in here at the web conference is not just how one computer works, but how a computer works when you think of it as one of millions and millions of computers all talking to each other across the network. So this year, we're trying to really define what web science is. We're trying to raise the awareness of the importance of studying the web as a big, complex thing. And it's great to be able to come to China, where already there is a lot of academic interest. Already we're in contact with various academic institutes about who are already starting to work in web science. A lot of people, I should say, have been doing web science for a long time, but in different disciplines. There have been mathematicians doing web science, psychologists doing web science, economists doing web science, computer scientists doing web science. One of the things we're doing with web science is bringing them together, getting them all to work together on the same really important problem. The web, this thing that is created by people all over the world working together, coming together just right now in Beijing, this conference, that is something which is in fact very important to the future. So the web conference is just starting. I'd recommend that if you have the time, you pick some pieces and go along to join and go and join some of the sessions. We've already had some workshops. One of the workshops that I went to was one on linked data, which is very exciting. The web you think of as a web of linked documents, where you browse through blogs, you browse through things like Wikipedia, you browse through information in documents. It's also on your computer, you have data files. So these data files are not on the web, mostly. When you have a calendar on your computer, you can do all kinds of things with it. You can look at it, look at months, you can look at weeks, you can look at days, you can look at things that you have to do, you can look at them you can manipulate the data in different ways. When you have the data on the web, on the calendar, it's just, when it's just as a document, it's boring. You can't manipulate it, you can't add it to the rest of the things in your, you can't compare it with your calendar yet with the other things that you want to do. So the what we call the semantic web is about taking those data files and putting them on the web, and to really make a web of data that you can explore, the technology is called linked data. And now there are some projects which call themselves linked open data, which are taking large amounts of data about people, about music tracks, about all kinds of things, and putting them out on the web to connect to other, and they're connecting them all up and making a very valuable resource. So that's just one of the things that's happened already at this web conference. Now that was those workshops happened on Monday and Tuesday, and for some people that was a time of indecision, because they also at that time that was the meeting of the World Wide Web Consortium. The World Wide Web Consortium is the group of people, companies, institutes who create the web technology. When you create web technology, you don't just invent it, you have to agree on an international standard which will be used the same, implemented the same on computers in every country, on all different sorts of computers, to make a new functionality on the web. So for example, to be able to make a new form of for example, video on the web. We need new standards for putting video on the web so that every player can access every movie, every clip. That's one of the things which is new and exciting. So the World Wide Web Consortium has had 2 days of meeting. They were really interesting, partly because we had people visiting from the Chinese standards bodies. We had a lot of extra people who are associated with the World Wide Web Consortium, but in China. And so we had discussions about getting China very much, all the huge number of creative Chinese engineers at Chinese companies and in the Chinese government, solidly involved in the development of international standards, which is very important. One comment I've heard already at this conference is that the international standards, it's very important that they represent the needs of Chinese users, the people who use the Chinese language, who use Chinese scripts, have Chinese culture. Very important, it's always been important from my point of view, that the web technology is universal and works for all countries and all languages. So getting every people involved in every country has always been very important. So those are the things that are happening. Web science is becoming a new field, a combination of other fields. The web conference is just starting. The WTC meeting was a great coming together of people internationally to steer the development of new standards. So, if you have any questions.
Please introduce yourself, if possible.
Okay. My name is Brian Zhang. I'm from Programmer Magazine, which is a software programmer developers magazine in China. I have 2 questions. The first one is, what do you think is the reason that the web, which is so simple, can beat up so many sophisticated distributed systems? The second one is, you have said that you have been focused on studying semantic web. And someone said, compared to the simplicity of the web, semantic web is too complicated to be successful. What's your opinion about that? If semantic web gets mature, what kind of shift will happen about web developers and programmers' job?
I can remember, you said 2, so I was remembering 2 questions. Okay. Let me they're both good questions. The first one. I'll be talking about the future to a certain extent, about what I'd like to see from web applications at the keynote, at the speech over the conference dinner. That's a great programmer's question, appropriate to the magazine, because programmers with experience know that simple systems work better. And in the web science, from the web science point of view, it is the simple things which multiply, which work, that fit together. I've blogged recently I actually spent a lot of time talking at the World Wide Web Consortium meeting about the importance of modularity. So when you design something, I always prefer to do it by designing little pieces which do a certain amount. So HTTP does a certain amount. The URI specification is independent of HTTP. The most URI specification is the most important part of the web, but you don't. It doesn't force you to use HTTP. You can use FTP. You can use new protocols. So there's a your ability to take out a module and put in another module. HTTP does the transfer of data. It transfers often HTML. HTML is one data format, but it's only one. So the HTML standard is supposed to be completely independent of the HTTP standard. When the HTML standard starts to get information in it about how to use HTTP, there's a problem. Why did the web spread? Because it's really simple. So obviously, so the second question is very natural. Why is the semantic web going to spread because it seems so complicated? Well, the fact is that the semantic web at base is simpler than the web. The semantic web is completely constructed, well, basically constructed out of triples, these sentences, which are subject, verb, object. The subject is identified with a URI, the verb is a URI, the object is a URI of another object, or it's a value. So subject, verb, object makes, if you like, a link, a very straightforward link. If you look at the complexity of HTML, the HTML specification at the moment, current HTML5 specification is 350 pages. I can give you an introduction to how to use, for example, a simple RDF language like Turtle or N3, which will fit onto one page. So you can get students, programmers, using basic semantic web technology, in fact, very simply. What is complicated is the people have built a lot on top. Because these triples are not just for humans to browse, because they're machines can do things, then you can put all kinds of very powerful applications. You can do inference using our ontology language. You can use rule languages, which we're just starting to standardize. We're making actually now some progress. We've had some first documents coming out of the rule interchange format working group. So it's really what seems to be the added complexity. Partly people think it's maybe more difficult to understand because it's more abstract, but I think it's because so much can be built on top of it. But at core, it is really, really simple. I think it's the simplest data model that there has ever been. So, okay, I hope that's helpful. I think we should, before we do that, maybe keep the third question, but we should, to be fair, we have a limited time, we should probably take that another one. Okay.
When you invest www, you open all the language so that we can use it for free today. And so I want to know what's your opinion about intellectual property.
Okay. We'll do royalty-free, the importance of royalty-free standards second. But first of all, the question is, why don't you see a lot of news about the semantic web? The semantic web, because it's data, as I was explaining, it's possible to do all sorts of things with it. So with the web, all the software has to do with the web document is to show it to you. With the semantic web, until the last 2 years, we didn't have semantic web browsers because people were just interested in moving the data so that it could be processed. Now, so the data has been moved around from one place to another. It's been looked up on the web, and it's been processed, and people have analyzed it. And that sort of thing tends to happen inside websites. It doesn't attract news. There's not a lot of news. I don't suppose there was a lot of news about database systems, you know, out there in the general papers. So to a certain extent, the semantic web is something which the users certainly for the last 2 years, haven't seen directly. Now, it's possible that that will change, because we started making semantic web browsers. We have, in fact, at those, I just saw a list of semantic web browsers. There were 3 last year, and there are 9 this year. So it's starting to take off. So if you look at the early adopters, if you're in the community of people, of engineers, of researchers, then you see an exponential growth. But an exponential growth, when you look at it, if you're in that community, you'll see it taking off. But it has, when you look at it from a larger scale, it still looks as though an exponential growth always, it looks as though it's flat, and then suddenly it seems to take off. But it all depends on the scale you look at it with. So if you're looking at it from the general press, it's not obvious yet. If you're looking at it, but if you're in the community of people who are adopting it, or the community of sciences, for example, life sciences, then there's a lot of excitement there, because people who are dealing with a huge amount of data that you need for drug discovery, they're finding it just what they need to solve the huge problems they had. And those are scientists that are using it. They're using it within the life sciences community. So if you go to life sciences conferences, then they'll find a lot of stuff about semantic web. But it's not, that's not the general news either.
Can I ask you, before the intellectual property question, it might be that people have heard more about how it's used rather than the underlying technology. Do you have any anecdote about semantic web technology usage where you could?
Well, in a way, it's, I'm loath to tell one particular story, because when originally we had the first, we had only a few web servers, and we had one, and very nobody had actually had web browsers, but you could connect them to a computer at CERN, which would allow you to browse, or give you a very simple interface, and it allowed you to browse, start off by browsing the library system at CERN. So this information got around. Lots of the only thing that journalists could use, so a lot of journalists connected, and the result was they said, oh, the World Wide Web is a system for browsing through a library. And semantic web has always had the problem that it's difficult to, it's a complete change in the way systems work. And it's such a complete change, it's very difficult to describe, and I can't do it justice, really. Maybe we could tell some advantages. I could talk about some things I'd prefer to do, but it takes some time. Yeah. I think. Okay. IPR. Yes. I think that if the CERN, for example, had tried to demand royalties for the web, it would not have taken off. There would be, now we have many, many, many small disconnected information systems, as we did before the web. So, everybody that I worked with in the internet community worked on the assumption that this was an exciting open space, that it was a very academic environment. Everybody believed in sharing their ideas, and they shared them by writing programs and sharing those programs. So if you like, it was open source before it was called open source. It was royalty free before it was called royalty free. At a certain point, as the web became bigger, as the amount of money flowing around the web increased, the World Wide Web Consortium found suddenly that people were threatening to charge royalties for World Wide Web technology. That was it was a shock, and it froze some of the technologies. People immediately walked away from them. They weren't allowed to use work on them by their lawyers. If they were volunteers, they thought, why should I put work in which is going to be used by another company? So in the consortium, then we just realized we had to formalize more the fact that it was royalty free. And we sat down with lawyers for a long time, and also we spent a long time, several years, convincing the large companies, making them realize that if the web was royalty free, then new markets would spread, huge new markets, from which they would make a lot of money. And they would make much more money from the new markets than from the royalties they get by trying to restrict the use of the technology. Over those years, we were successful in making large companies, which had were very involved in IPR before, changed their attitude. And we've established then now a royalty-free policy which allows people to participate in WPC activities so that the end product, the core infrastructure standards which make the web work, are royalty-free. And that is one of the most important, one of the most important things, in fact, about W3C as a place. For engineers, it's one of the more boring things, but in reality, for the points of making it as a place to meet and develop new technologies, it's one of the most fundamental things.
Okay. I'm going to have to pass on
the obstacles. What problems? I'll tell you about a press conference I was at MIT. There was a big table and everybody was sitting around with notepads, as you people do. And the question was, so what do you think about the future of the web? What are the opportunities and what are the challenges? So I talked about the opportunities of the semantic web, and I talked about the opportunities from mobile web, and I talked about the opportunities from web on video. And I said, now, and sort of looking on the other side at some of the possible problems, and everybody looks up, and all the pencils started to move, and the BBC and the Guardian online said, Berners-Lee fears demise of web. Berners-Lee worried about... So let me first say that I am extremely optimistic. The web has been a tremendous tool for people to do a lot of good, even though you can find bad stuff out there. The web has been, and the experience of the development of the web by so many people collaborating across the globe has been just a fantastic experience. That experience continues, and the spirit of international collaboration continues. Also, the spirit that really we have only started to explore the possibilities, that continues. To think that to look back on the web after 15 years is in fact wrong. We have to get a foothold on this 15 years and look forward. The future is always longer than the past, and for the web particularly. 15 years, in 100 years, 15 years will seem to be just the infancy of the web. Before we even got the web, the semantic web wasn't even completely deployed. You couldn't even find all the data in the world immediately at your fingertips and things like that. So the challenge is, I think, we have to be on the lookout to make sure that the technology that we designed allows us to produce a web which has the social properties that we want. One of the things we noticed when we talk about web science is that the engineering of the web, it's about a system, but the computers are actually only the servants in that system. Really, the web, when somebody makes the link from their blog and then somebody else follows it, it's the person making the web, the link. It's the person following the link. What drives that person determines whether the link gets made. So the web design really involves the psychology of the person who wants the kudos of having people reading their web page, and they did realize that if they make a good link from their web page will be more valuable. Maybe they'll get more people reading their page. So the web is, you have to think of the web as humanity connected. So, and I've always stressed to the technical people, the engineers around here, that they should remember that the web is there for a social need. And so clearly, the challenge is to always make sure that we have that the technologists look at it with an eye always to the social side of it, and that people looking at it from the social side, developing policies, do that with a very strong awareness of understanding of the technology. So one of the things we're looking to for web science is to not bridge the gap, but close the gap, to produce a lot of people who call themselves web scientists, who understand both sides, who have in the same head the the need, the driving social need to make the world a better place, and the sparks of ideas about how they can possibly do it. So clearly things like keeping the infrastructure royalty free is important. Clearly thinking about privacy. Nowadays also, it's not just privacy, it's privacy. We realize that a lot of people, for example, in government departments or in a hospital have access to a lot of information where they can use it for one purpose but not for another. So now, where at MIT we've done research into systems which keep track of the use of information. They allow you to say where this information came from, but also where it's going to, what you can use it for. Build systems so that if, for example, I'm a law enforcement agent and I pulled in a lot of data, and then I'm going to use it to arrest you according to the law, different laws of the country. In America, for example, there's wiretapping data, which the government uses only for terrorism. They can't use it to arrest you if you haven't paid for your library book, brought your library book back. And so keeping track, and in a hospital, similarly, some information is available in emergencies, but it's not available just for registering somebody. So one of the things, the challenges in the future, is building systems which are accountable. There are a huge number of areas where we have to be careful, obviously. I'll just mention one more. One of the things which is, I think, an area of opportunity as well. You find that a lot of these social networking sites form groups. You find places like Wikipedia allow communities to do things together, like build an encyclopedia. They are finding that they have to introduce new forms of governance, how do they make decisions, how do they decide what's right, how does Wikipedia decide what's true, how does the scientific community, in an age when people don't use physical papers anymore, how do they decide what should be published, how do they decide what is accepted scientific truth, and how much of it is not. What's exciting is that people are building new social systems, new systems of review, new systems of governance. And I think that my hope is that those will produce, we'll learn new ways of working together effectively and fairly, which we can use globally to manage ourselves as a planet. Sorry to end up on the opportunity instead of a challenge.
There was a second question as well. The second question was maybe you answered on openness.
There was a question on openness. Okay. First of all, the web, when I was selling the web, explaining the web to people early on, there were some people thought I was trying to say that everything should be available, all information should be available. And I constantly have to separate. Wait a moment. When you use standards, that does not mean you make all your information available to everybody. So, for example, in the company, it's very important that a company should use, for example, semantic web standards, standards like XML, in order to just be able to use information in different places in the company, so that if you ask me for information and I send it to you, if you can't use it, it's not because of some stupid technological incompatibility. If you don't use it, it's because I've decided I don't want to give it to you, because the rules of the company mean that I shouldn't give it to you, you're not allowed to see it. That, of course, all that social structure around information is very important. So openness about information. Now, there is more openness, because when you have interoperability from the standards, then this allows openness. So whereas you see WCC brings the standards, they bring the interoperability. And as interoperability comes, you see a progressive openness. Yes, some companies are more open than others. Some countries are more open than others. I think there is a general global trend towards greater openness. I think that groups of all sizes find that they tend to work better when other groups can see what they're doing. For example, if you have a manufacturing plant and your buyers can see what your stock levels are, they find it easier to plan. You're easier to deal with if you tell them what your stock levels are. it's easier to see if you can, you know, if you're going to buy from somebody, to see what their discounts are, what their prices are, to see which pieces are compatible with which, without having to telephone them, if you can pick it up in data from the semantic web. That's easier. So I think we found that the web, for example, for, you know, bookshops online, they moved towards more and more information being available. They started off without any catalogs, and then they put catalogs. But then some of them put prices online. But they didn't put stock levels online because they felt that was private information. And then people got fed up with ordering a book and finding it wasn't available, it was out of stock. So then the bookshops put stock levels online. I think so that there's a sort of, in the commercial world, there's a competitive drive to be open in order to be a better business partner. Also, we see lots, you know, in the world in general, governments are tending to be more open, but everybody realizes that changing that sort of thing is something which is, which you can't do overnight. It's a long process that has to be done carefully, and sometimes one takes two steps forward and one step backwards.
By the way, I want to thank everyone for speaking English. It might be that some people have questions they want to say in Chinese. I think we have help. If you want to ask your question in Chinese as well. So, Cindy.
Hey. Okay, to take the first one, the second one is no, I can't, because I won't. I'm director of the World Wide Web Consortium, which is a vendor-neutral organization, so I don't predict who's going to be the next multi-billionaire. So we can concentrate on your first question. First question, yes, to a certain extent, the semantic web has a tremendously exciting role in opening things up. So for example, if you imagine that there's an American website which gives you the weather. And when you go to it as a human being using the document web, then you see a document which has got the weather. And it says sunny, 10 degrees. Well, it's America, it would say sunny, 42 degrees Fahrenheit. And it would have a picture of a sun. Okay, and it would have... But it would have a description of what basically the weather and the wind speed and the humidity and the fact that it's sunny and the temperature would be expressed in English. Now maybe that American website actually has weather data for the whole world, so that you're in fact it's very up to date. So you're in Beijing and you want to access it. Now when you access it as a document, then it's in the wrong language. If that data was expressed as numbers, but on the semantic web it would be expressed as numbers, where attached to each number there's a URI which explains what it means. It says, this is the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit. This is a code which is sort of one if it's sunny, two if it's rainy, and so on. Then when it's expressed as data, then I could go to it from my phone and have something on my phone which understands the meaning of those numbers. Not only that, but it could realize that I prefer Celsius temperature, so it could convert it from Fahrenheit to Celsius, and it could put up display the weather for me as I using my own language. So whether there's data which is numeric, for example, then, or whether data is there's a particular set of vocabulary like sunny, windy, cloudy, then those can be translated into many, many languages once and for all. So when you, for example, when you go to the linked open data out there and you find something like a URI for Berlin, you'll find that there are many names. You'll find it listed in lots of European languages, in Chinese characters. You'll find it in Arabic, because people, and And that means every time somebody uses that URI for Berlin, any Arabic-speaking person using the software will get a label on it they can read. So that's one of the exciting things about Semantic Web. Okay, so Cindy got one out. So if we have spare time, we'll come back to Cindy if she got an extra one. Because I cancelled one of your one.
Coming up to the end, do we have time for a couple more. Did you have a question?
I'm from China Education Network. I'm one question. How do you think about IPv6, the application in IPv6?
That IPv6 is not my layer. It's not the layer that I'm an expert on. One of the nice things about the way the internet is designed is that the web technology uses the internet layer and doesn't have to know anything about what's happening underneath. So to a large extent, if the internet is upgraded and gets IPv6 everywhere, then the web just can use it better. I could say from one of that there is one way in which perhaps the web technology is poorer because of the lack of IPv6. What in IPv4, when you have so many things on the internet, like your phone, like all the devices in my home, like my refrigerator, which might have a screen on it, when they can't all have internet addresses in the IPv4 world. The internet address is not the number isn't big enough. In the IPv6 world, everything can get an internet address. So what we call the ubiquitous web, where you have pieces of information on all these devices and I can interact with them all in a seamless way, it's much easier to do exciting new technology for the ubiquitous web when everything has an internet address. So IPv6 will help. At the moment, what happens is you have a family firewall box and the refrigerator's behind that. And the whole family house, certainly typically in the United States, the house has only one IP address. You can't connect from work, you can't connect up to the state of your refrigerator to make sure it's still working. So there'll be a few other ways, but in general, just the better internet technology works, the better for the web. There's somebody over there.
Hi, I'm Grant Webster. I write the Sinobite blog on the CNET blog network. Mm-hmm. Certain countries develop their own standards for various things. It's happening right now in China with cell phones, for instance. Do you see anything like this happening on the internet? And if so, how does that interact with global standards? What is the advantage of the global standards?
Before the internet and before the web, we could have talked about that. The advantages of global standards were largely trade, that if you build a cell phone to match the standard, the European standard, then you could sell in Europe and so on. And yes, for example, America didn't manage to do that, and China similarly. But now, with the web, clearly the connectivity is such that your blog will be read. You might publish it in China, it'll be read by people all over the world. So the idea of having an area in which you use one kind of blog software and another, and then a continent on which you use another kind of blog software and they don't interoperate just makes no sense. If you're trying to draw a line through the web and say that, that's actually within that area, we'll have a different standard. One of the critical areas that we're concerned about excited and concerned about in the World Wide Web Consortium is video on the web. And so one of the crucial things where we would like to have a royalty-free standard is for the video codec. Now, that video codecs have not been developed in the World Wide Web Consortium. They were developed largely by standards bodies, other standards bodies. And we'll all try very hard to try to arrange that there should be, but we'd like to have there to be one. Clearly, where the international standards are not royalty-free, there's an incentive to create a national standard. But And so, in a way, that underlines the importance of making things royalty-free. Also note that when there are royalty terms payable, sometimes those can seem much larger to different countries, and in particular, China has this growing economy and may be able to pay royalties and charge royalties, but a developing country which would like to develop software may just not be in the position that the royalties ask may be just look too much too large. So in a way, that's very unfair. So royalty-free technologies are important. What else was I going to say about international standards and national standards? One thing is that it's difficult to make international standards. You have to meet with people from different cultures. We do it in the consortium. It's actually, of course, very rich and rewarding. But it's a lot of work. It means that you have to attend teleconferences at horrible times of night sometimes. If the majority of the people on the call are in America and you happen to be living in China, as Mauro is at the back of the situation, he knows very well, you end up getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. If the American majority of people on the call speak one language and you speak, and it's a hard one for you to manage, you may find it difficult to understand what's going on, difficult to make your point made. So it may be tempting to join a local group. To know you have lots of people you work with, and maybe it's geographically much easier to you meet. There are people you meet at national conferences; it's very easy to meet with. So we have to be careful that we actually use the internet as much as we can, which can remove the necessity to get on a plane. But it doesn't remove the time zone, it doesn't remove the language barrier, and it doesn't remove the cultural barrier. You know, we find that different nationalities are more apt to interrupt each other. So sometimes maybe we'll end up with some national standards just because people didn't put the effort in to join the international standards body, to get to understand how it works, to fly and to get up in the middle of the night for teleconferences. What I'd point out to is that this is a lot of work making these international standards. If you know somebody who's involved in it, you should buy them a drink.
Okay, so before we wrap up, and I'd like to thank everybody for coming out today, taking the time, I wanted to ask Tim if you have any questions for the people who are here.
Oh, you should have given me notice of that. I would have had 16.
You get one, just like everyone.
They got two.
You don't have time. I'm sorry, you only have one.
So, I suppose, for those of you who are familiar with the web in China, and you've also browsed the web in the US, what would you say was the biggest differences between the web culture and what you find on the web and how the web is used in China compared to, say, in the US? See, I'm not used to asking them. I'm not used to answering the questions. Do you have my camera?
I do.
Okay.
You get to take pictures too.
Yeah. One of the things that you may not be used to is that I believe in this reciprocal right. But if you take pictures of me, I can take pictures of you. Okay.
Thank you all. If you have any other questions, please come up and talk to me if you'd like, or Marie-Claire Forg, who's also on the W3C communications team, and we'll happily take your cards and try to talk to you about any other questions you have. So thanks again for joining, and enjoy the conference.
Yes.
Thank you, Professor, for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry about the booth.
Oh, no,
I couldn't resist
totally
it.
It's okay, don't worry about it. All right.
I have still my name card for you.
Yeah.
You have to give me to me. Yeah.
That's true. That's very rude of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Tomorrow. Tomorrow. You have. Oh, it's for you.
Yes, I know. but I just put them together.
Yeah, tomorrow you have to give a speech in the other place. So I want to have a half an hour to have a separate interview with you and ask you some questions. Yeah, and several months ago, I wrote an email to the dean, and she said you haven't have time to write to me. So I have I like to have the face to face the interview about tomorrow.
Yeah.
对对对。